I really enjoyed reading this chapter. Is that better? Good. And I learned so much from it. And I hope that I can be able to present as at least a small percentage of what I studied. I titled this chapter, God Prepares Moses for Servant Leadership. God prepares Moses for servant leadership. The theme of Exodus, as we see it here now, is God is redeeming Israel for himself and is entering into a covenant relationship with them. That is really good news. The theme of this chapter, as I perceived it, is God is patiently equipping a deliverer for his nation Israel to bring his people out from Egyptian slavery. Why? So that they may glorify him in the land that he promised them through their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, I'm going to continue what Brother Mike has taught us because this is still part of the introduction. What we saw last time is that Exodus chapter 1 continued from Genesis. In fact, the beginning of Exodus chapter 1 just basically says something very similar to the latter part of Genesis, where Jacob's descendants, about 70, went to Egypt. They went there because there was famine in the land at the time. And so Joseph was already there, and he had a high position in Egypt. And what they had done, they had, under his wisdom that God had given him, they stored up grain. They had 7 years of good times, and then they had 7 years of famine. So Joseph was the prime minister in Egypt at that time, very high position. And so he told them to store up grain during these plentiful, bountiful years, because there will be 7 years of famine. When it comes, we will have grain. And so the Israelites had the opportunity to go there because Joseph is a son of Jacob or Israel. And so that's why he was there already. And he had a couple sons as well. So anyway, in our passage today, we find God's people in Egypt. And that's why they went there, because of the famine many years prior to that, or some years prior to that. And so as this chapter unfolds, we will see that they have been there for quite some time. Because God made a promise or a prophecy to Abraham, even before Abraham had any children, especially Isaac. Isaac was not even born yet, and God made an amazing prophecy to him. And what we're studying now is beginning of a fulfillment of that prophecy. Because God is a faithful God. He does what he says he's going to do. And whatever he says is going to happen, is going to happen because he's the one who causes it to happen the way that he determined that it would happen for his own purposes and glory. So as a little background here, I want us to turn in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 15. I read this often. I find it so good because God is so good, and he's going to fulfill all of his good purposes, all of these good promises that he's made to us. God is going to fulfill them. He's going to do it. So we don't have to worry about that. And I love the way he calls this to be written. Look at verse 12, beginning in verse 12 of chapter 15 of Genesis. He says, "Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram." You know, Abram's name is, this is Abraham. And I may just say Abraham from now on. "And behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abraham, 'Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward," that is, after I judge them, "they will come," that nation, "they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation, they, that is your descendants, will return here. For the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. This is an amazing prophecy, and we can already see that it's being fulfilled. Where are the sons of Israel now? In Egypt. We didn't necessarily know it was going to be Egypt at that time. It's described here as a land that is not theirs, right? And it's not theirs because God did not promise Egypt to them. He promised the land of Canaan to them. So they're there, they are there now. And what is their status? Slavery. That's what he said. Abraham was probably shocked when God gave him this because God had promised him and his descendants the promised land, the land of Canaan, right? But he was not going to have any ownership there. I mean, as a nation, he's not going to live as the children come back to that land. And many of them, in fact, all of them, none of them had actually been in it before. This is amazing. And God is carrying this out. So God is going to judge the nation that enslaves them and causes them so much hardship, as we will see when we get to chapters 7 through 9 or 10 in the plagues. And then it's going to take a long time because God is always doing something, and he's doing more than one thing. He's doing a lot of things, and certain things have to come in place before he fulfills certain things, other things. And that's what he's doing here. For example, you may pray. I know I'm getting a little off subject here. You may pray and wonder, why does it take God so long to answer? Well, God is maybe doing a million things or more, and certain other things has to come in place before he answers your prayer. That's the way God is. He's infinite. He has so many things going on at the same time. And he's concerned about all people, not just me. And so that's what's going on now. But the Amorites, he says, verse 16, then in the fourth generation, they, that is your descendants, will return here. Why? It's going to take that long? For the iniquity of the Amorite is not complete. The Amorite is kind of a summary of all the different groups of people that live in the promised land. They're sinful people. But it's not time to judge them yet. So it's going to take a while before their sins are complete, or their cup is full of sins. And then God is going to bring the Israelites in there to judge them. Not to judge them per se, but to drive them out. That's a form of judgment. So that's what's going on. But anyway, that's kind of a background to this. And so God is fulfilling this now, and he will continue to fulfill it. So at this particular point in time, the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, has put some edicts in place because the children of the sons of Israel were growing so rapidly. They were growing so rapidly, as Brother Mike already told us. And so he wanted to curb their growth. He put taskmasters over them to work them severely, cause them to participate in real hard labor, thinking that that might cause some decline in their growth. That didn't work. Then he talked to the midwives to tell them every male child, that is every Hebrew male child, kill it when it's born. It must have been a pretty cruel man, right? Really cruel man. And then that didn't work because they feared God and they defied him. So they didn't do what he told them. And then the third thing he put in place was when a male child is born, throw him into the Nile. Nile is a pretty big river. And the babies at that age can't swim. And so they would have drowned. So he was really cruel. That didn't work either. Well, it did, but maybe it did work, but it didn't work in terms of the person that we'll be talking about this morning. So let's go ahead and get started. That is the context in which the deliverer of the people of God was born. The deliverer was born under a curse. Under a curse. So let's look at it. Verses 1 through 4, I called a deliverer is born. Look at verse 1. This is in chapter 2, verse 1. He says, now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. I wonder who these people are. Let's take a look. First of all, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they are the forefathers. Levi, and most of you know this already. Some of you may not, but I want to make sure everyone knows this before we leave today. Levi is the third son of Jacob, born to Leah. You know, Jacob had two wives and he had two concubines for the most part. And so Levi was the third son of Jacob by his first wife, Leah. Not that he divorced another wife. He had two wives. And so Levi was by Leah. And he was of the priestly tribe, as we will learn later on. You can see this in Exodus chapter 6, verses 16, 18, and 20. Now, who is the man, in verse 1, that went to the house of Levi and married a daughter of Levi? Well, let's turn over to Exodus chapter 6. We'll find out. Go to Exodus chapter 6. This is the genealogy that I mentioned that I'll talk about a little bit. We're only going to be highlighting the people that's applicable to this particular situation. There are many other names, but we're not going to go to them. In chapter 6 of Exodus, there's a genealogy, a brief genealogy. And this genealogy actually stops at Levi. Look at verse 16. He says, these are the names of the sons of Levi, according to their generations. And he lists the names of them. But the one that we'll be interested in, he says, Gershom and Kohath. Kohath is the one that we're interested in. Now look at verse 18. The sons of Kohath. Kohath. Is that right? Amram. Amram is the one we're interested in now. Now let's go to verse 20. Amram married his father's sister, Jochebed. Okay? Now, and what happened there? And she, Jochebed, bore him Aaron and Moses. Okay? Now let's go back to chapter 2, verse 1. Now, let's reread this. Now, Amram, from the house of Levi, went and married Jochebed, daughter of Levi. Everybody see that? I'm just substituting the names of the people that are listed here in verse 1. Everybody follow that? That'll be on the quiz next week. Yes, that's transitive providence. Exactly right. Everybody good? I want to make sure everybody follows me. All right, so that's the situation here. So Amram went to the house of Levi and married Jochebed, who's also of the family of Levi. Jochebed, verse 2, conceived. Now that shouldn't sound strange to anybody that she conceived, because at this time, the Israelites were really productive. They were really productive, as we've already learned. And bore a son. Bore a son. You know why I said, They were under a penalty, right? They were under a penalty. And this is a Hebrew son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, what does beautiful mean? Beautiful. She hid him for 3 months. She hid him for 3 months. Now, babies, when they are, you know, really young, when they're first born, they're pretty quiet, right? They're pretty quiet. They're not? They are mostly concerned about eating, sleeping, and making sure that their diapers are changed. Is that right? That's what they're in. But when they become like three or four months old, they get a little stronger. Their voices get a little louder. And so that's probably why she hid him for 3 months, because it says she hid him for 3 months because she couldn't hide him anymore. She began to get afraid because the sons were under death penalty. Notice verse 3. When she could not hide him any longer, she got him a wicker basket. Now, there's probably a better translation for this word. Who knows what it is? Ark. This word is ark. It's the same word that Moses used, who wrote the book of Genesis, in the section of Genesis, chapters 6 through 9, somewhere in there, uses the same word. You remember that God told Noah to build an ark because the flood was coming to judge the people? This is the same word. It's the same word. So she got an ark and put Moses into it. And she not only put him into it, but she put the ark among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. Reeds are relatively strong plants. They grow pretty tall. And she didn't just throw him in there anywhere. She didn't just throw the ark in there anywhere. She put it among the reeds so that it would remain. It wouldn't float down the river. Now, I think she was kind of expecting something to happen. I think she was expecting to see this child again because of the care that she was taking. Now, notice verse 4. His sister, Moses' sister here is Miriam. Her name is not mentioned here, but her name is Miriam, who was older than Moses. She was probably about 6-7 years old at this time. She stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. So she was watching. Maybe her mom had already gone home, apparently so. But she stayed. And it's amazing what we're going to learn about her behavior and actions in a minute. Now notice God's providence working here. The daughter of Pharaoh came down, verse 5, to bathe in the Nile. And Miriam was standing there watching. With her maidens, walking along the side of the Nile. Now, her maidens were probably walking along the side of the Nile, perhaps for privacy for Pharaoh's daughter, so she could have some privacy when she went into the river to bathe. Probably not deep water at that point. And she saw the basket or the ark among the reeds and sent for her maid, and she brought it to her. Now, I'm sure she was curious about this basket or this ark, wondering, what is it, number one, and why is it there? And so she asked her maid to bring it to her. And a maid did. She brought it to her at the end of verse 5. Now, she opened it, verse 6. When she opened it, she saw the child. There was a child inside this box or this basket or this ark. And behold, now notice how she switches terms here. The boy. The boy. Uh-oh. There was a boy in there. And the boy was crying. I guess so. The boy was crying. And notice what she said. And she, that is Pharaoh's daughter, had pity on him. That is absolutely amazing. She had pity on him. What was she supposed to do under the edict that was in place? She was supposed to throw him into the Nile. But that is not what she did. She had pity on him. You remember Jesus when he looked at some people with diseases and so forth, what did he do? He had pity on them, and he acted regarding that pity that he had on them, and in many cases, he healed them or whatever needed to be done. So she had pity on him and said, I'm in verse 6, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Not only was it a boy, a male, but it was a Hebrew boy. And Pharaoh had told all of his people to kill every male child that was born to the Hebrews, but save the female children alive. So she had pity on him. Now, look at verse 4 again. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Now, this is absolutely amazing here. When apparently she could hear what was being said, apparently his sister Miriam could hear the conversation or the discussion going on between Pharaoh's daughter and her maidens. It seems like when she heard the word Hebrew children, she sprung into action. Notice verse 7. Then his sister, Miriam, said to Pharaoh's daughter, and I love this, "Shall I go and call a nurse for him from among the Hebrew women?" You see how things are shaping up here? They're really shaping up. But I love the way she asked the question. She didn't say, "I'm going to go get a Hebrew woman and bring her here." She said, "Shall I go?" Sometimes it's better to ask a question than to make a statement, even though the results are the same. The turnout of all of this is the same. She says, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?" Now, what do you think Miriam knew here? She knew a Hebrew woman that could nurse this child, right? Not only was she Moses' mom, but whose else mom was she? Her mom. She needed, at this time, she knew that Pharaoh's daughter needed a wet nurse. That's what this turns out to be. She needed a wet nurse. And she said, "May I go get one?" Notice what Pharaoh's daughter said. Look at verse 8. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." Now, Pharaoh's daughter probably didn't know at this time who this nurse would be. She said, "Go get one." So the girl went in the middle of verse 8 and called, guess who? The child's, that is Moses' mother, Jochebed. She called her mother. Do you see God's providence working here? Now, God's name is not even in this portion of this chapter. We don't see the word God until we get to verse 23. But God's fingers are all over this. God is working behind the scenes, orchestrating all of this. This is what's called divine providence. And that's the way God works. Pastor Thomas told us more than one time that sovereignty is who God is. Providence is what he does. You probably heard that, right? Providence is what he does. That's amazing, isn't it? That's amazing. He's working. Yes. He can use anyone he chooses for his purpose. Why? He's sovereign, and what else? Huh? For his glory? What else? Genesis 1:1 says what? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Psalm 24:1 says what? The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And what else? And all those who dwell in it. Everyone belongs to God. Everyone belongs to God. Satan belongs to God. The demons belong to God. Everything, every created thing belongs to God. Why? Because he brought it into existence. It's his. And he can choose to use whatever he wants to use, or anyone to use, any way he wants to use them, because everyone and everything is his. And that's what he's doing here. I understand that this woman here, Pharaoh's daughter, was not a pleasant woman all the time. So Pharaoh's daughter, in verse 8, said to her, "Go." So the girl went, that is Miriam in this case, and called the child's mother. And she was a ready nurse for this child. Let's go on to verse 9. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to Miriam, "Take the child away and nurse him for me." Now, to her. Her right now is the mother of Jochebed in verse 9. Her is Jochebed, okay? I made a mistake there. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to Jochebed, take this child away and nurse him for me, and watch this, and I will give you your wages. Isn't God amazing? Jochebed is going to get paid to serve her function that she was, had been serving and will continue to serve. She's going to get paid to nurse her own son, who was born under a death sentence. God is an amazing God. We see the greatness of God here. We see how great God is. That's part of what's being brought out here, I think. God is overall. So now, Jochebed is going to nurse her own son, whom she hid 3 months because he was under a death sentence because he was a Hebrew male. Now she's not going to have to worry about that. She has an authorization now from the Pharaoh's daughter to take this child home and nurse it, take care of it. He has it. Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. Anybody else want to comment on this? I just love this. God is in control of everything and everyone. It doesn't matter how much the Israelites are being enslaved right now. God is in control of that situation. And he had already promised this. He told Abraham that your descendants would be what? Enslaved for a long time. And that's exactly what's happening to them. Another thing we could probably point out here is that even though they are enduring great hardship, slavery, abuse, God can give them the stamina, even though it's painful to them. He can give them the endurance to bear up under this until it's time for him to give them relief. That's true with us. I know sometimes we hurt. We're in pain. We're suffering. It's difficult. Difficult. We don't always know what to do. God has the power. He has the grace. He has the ability to give us the endurance that we need in order for us to be sustained until it's time for those circumstances to end. Isn't that comfort in that? There's great comfort in that. I know life is challenging. It's challenging for all of us. But God is greater than whatever our circumstances he might bring into our lives might be. He's greater. Our God is greater. We sing a song called Our God is Greater. He is. Yes, sir. Huh? Isn't that an irony? That's amazing, isn't it? He did. He sent him to Egypt not to be killed when the people from the land came. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. God is in control of the king. He's in control of everyone. So we can trust him with that. I wrote some notes, but I'm not really following them right now. But anyway, that's actually Roman numeral 2 where we are right now. And I also want to point out that some parallel passages to this, which many of you probably already know, are Acts chapter 7 and Hebrews chapter 11. And we may refer to some of them from time to time. And I'm missing some things. I've skipped some things at times. But let's look at verses 5 through 10, which we already are in. So let's continue. Notice verse 10. The child grew, and she, that is, Jochebed, brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. Now Moses is now being adopted. We could see this building even before now. Moses was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter and became her child. So now Moses is taken into the palace, into the court of the Pharaoh, where Pharaoh's daughter is. And notice, I didn't mention this before, but back in verse 1, we see some things here. A man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi, verse 2, and the woman conceived and bore a son. What do you think is missing right here that we would normally expect to see? Huh? There's no name. That's exactly right. We don't see the name there. You notice that? There's no name there. Why? We're going to see this in a minute. Let's go to it right now. In verse 10, when Jochebed brought Moses back to Pharaoh's daughter, what did she do? Look at the middle of verse 10. And she, that is Pharaoh's daughter, named him Moses. In fact, we don't see the word Moses until now. But we knew who we were talking about all along, right? She named him Moses. Why? She said, because I drew him out of the water. And that's what Moses means, Moshe, to draw out. And I don't want to go too far, but that's what she named him. And I think that name is fitting because later on, Moses is going to lead or draw out these sons of Israel through the water, even though it's going to be on dry land. He does it. God is an amazing God. And that's why we study books like this, because we can see his wonders, his greatness, his majesty, and what he actually can do and what he does for his people to fulfill his purpose in the world, in and through them. Now, let's look at verse 11. Verses 11 through 15. I named that some of the failings of Moses. Moses had some failures too, just like we all do. But God can still work with us and use us in spite of our failings. If he based his use of us on our failings, he wouldn't have any humans to use. We all fail. We all fail at times. Now look at verse 11. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up. Now, in Acts chapter 7, verse 23, you don't have to turn there. Well, you can write it down if you want to. I think this is the right verse. For some reason, I didn't put it on yours. Acts chapter 7, verse 23. This is Stephen giving his sermon to the Sanhedrin. Acts 7, 23. Notice what he says here. But when, this is Acts 7, 23, but when he, that is Moses, was approaching the age of 40, at this time, Moses is about 40 years old. And we can actually see that because babies at that time, they wouldn't be weaned until about 3 to 4 years. And if you add another 35 years to that, it's approximately 40 years. In fact, Moses' life, as many of you know, was in three increments of 40 years. He lived to be 120. So he spent basically 40 years in Pharaoh's house, and then we'll see that he leaves and goes somewhere else for 40 years, and then he wandered with the children of Israel in the wilderness for about 40 years. So that's, you add that all up, you get 120. Now let's go back to verse 11. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up, at this time he was about 40 years old, that he went out to his brethren and looked on their labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. What word do you see in that two times? Brethren, brothers. You know, Moses may have grown up in Pharaoh's court, and he was trained in all the learning and the wisdom of the Egyptians. But where was his affection? Where was his affinity? To the Hebrews. Now, another thing, there's so much going on here, that I didn't point out earlier is that during that time, those 3 to 4 years that Pharaoh's daughter asked Jochebed, Moses' mother, to take him home, take him to your house and nurse him for me. She was nursing him. She was probably telling him who he was, who he belonged to, and all of those things. I don't know whether she knew about this prophecy that God had given to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob or not, but they knew a lot about what their purposes were and what they were supposed to do. She probably instilled in him that he was a Hebrew, and that's who he is. He's in a different category because he's part of God's chosen people than anybody else. She may have told him that. I can't say for certain. But he knew who the Hebrews were and that they were an enslaved people. And when he was about 40 years old, now he's no longer a baby in an ark or basket. He is now a grown man. He's 40 years old. And notice what he did. He went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors. Apparently, Moses was a man of action here. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. He's not going to let that slide. He's not going to let that happen. His people are already being enslaved under hard labor and hard taskmasters. Now he sees one of the Egyptians actually beating one of his family members, a Hebrew. And he's going to impose himself into this situation. Notice verse 12. So he looked this way and that way. And I'll tell you what that means in a minute. And when he saw this, when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. In other words, he killed the Egyptian. He was probably trained as a military person as he was being schooled in the Egyptian court, and he knew how to kill somebody. So he actually killed the Egyptian. And not only did he kill him, he hid him in the sand. That is, he buried him to try to put him out of sight, which was not a good thing to do, but that's what he did. But Moses, at this point, you notice he looked this way and that way. Was he operating by sight or by faith? Huh? He looked. He was operating by sight at this point. So now Moses was 40 years old. He had been trained in all the learning and wisdom of the Egyptians, but he wasn't quite ready for the assignment that God had for him yet. He wasn't ready for that. His spiritual level was not where it should have been for what God wanted him to do. He went out the next day, verse 13, and behold, two Hebrews, now these are his brethren, were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, why are you striking your companion? You're brothers. Why are you striking him? He's not your enemy. But sometimes when we are under difficult situations or in difficult situations, we can get a little terse with fellow members, right? Our family or even members in the church. It can happen. But Moses was seeking justice. He wanted justice, and he imposed himself in this situation. But the one who was doing the striking didn't like it. Notice what he said, verse 14. But he said, that is the one who was perhaps in the wrong, maybe in the wrong, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Uh-oh. there was somebody watching, right? There was someone watching. Now Moses had looked this way and that way, but he didn't see anybody, right? So he went on and took the action of killing the Egyptian who was beating the Hebrew. But now we learn somebody was watching. And I can say this, somebody's watching us too. We're being watched. Whenever you're in public, there's probably a camera on you. You're being watched, right? You are being watched. If you're not being watched by a human, you're being watched by a divine one, by God himself. We're always being watched by someone. That's the middle of verse 14. Then Moses, when verse 14, was afraid because he didn't think anybody saw him. He was operating in the flesh. He was operating in the flesh. God did not intend for Moses to deliver his people by killing people. If anybody was going to kill anybody, he was the one to do it, which we will learn later on. He says, surely, this is what Moses said, the matter has become known. It's out in the public now. So let's go to the next section, beginning in verse 16. Yes, sir. That's exactly right. Yes, exactly. In fact, we're going to read that passage. Now, here's some of the things that Moses did while he was operating in the flesh. He killed the Egyptian who was beating his Hebrew brother, verse 12. He buried the evidence in the sand, verse 12. He imposed himself in a dispute between two members of his brethren, verse 13. He imposed himself as some kind of a judge or ruler in the case of his quarreling brethren, verse 14. So Moses didn't always live by faith. He was fleshly, just like we are sometimes. He was not operating by the Spirit, but he was operating in the flesh. At this point, he was not moving in step with God, but moving ahead of God. Moses wanted to get it done right now. But when the time came to do it, he was more hesitant. We'll see that next time. It is clear that Moses loved his people and had a passion to help them. But it did not seem that he was quite ready yet. That happens to us. Sometimes we have a passion to do something, but we may not be ready yet. We may not have the right temperament. We may not have the level of humility that we should have. We may not have the level of patience, kindness, tolerance, and so forth that we should have. So Moses needed some spiritual maturity before God would actually give him the assignment that he had determined for him. And he's going to provide that opportunity. Look at verse 15. When Moses heard of the matter, when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. This is another amazing thing about God. God will get us to where we need to be in order to teach us the lesson that he knows we need to learn. He's going to cause this man to leave the palace and go out into a wilderness, meander around with flock for 40 years. And as he's meandering around with flock, he'll learn the lesson that God knows that he needs to learn in order to fulfill the purpose for which he's actually existing and was kept alive providentially earlier on. And so, it was also probably during this time that Brother Ron, what you were talking about, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 24 through 26. Notice what this says. This is an amazing passage. He says, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, that is, when he was about 40 years old at the time, refused. That means he said no to. Refused means saying no to. He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. In other words, he's going to unadopt himself. He's going to nullify his adoption. I've heard of nullifying a marriage, but I hadn't heard of nullifying an adoption. He refused to be called, even though she may, I can't say for certain, she may have told him, don't do it. But he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. What did he do? Choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. So what did Moses turn his back on? He turned his back on a lot. What did he turn his back on? Wealth, for sure. Luxury. Power. Fame. And perhaps even the throne of Egypt. He turned his back on that. Why? Notice what the verse says. He was considering that the reproach of Christ was greater than the treasures of Egypt. Are you willing to do that? I had to ask myself that question this week. Am I willing to forsake everything that I'm a stewardship, that I have a stewardship of in my possession to follow Christ? Am I willing to do that? That's the question that we want to think about. Moses did it. He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He forsook that and everything that possibly came along with that. He turned his back on it. Now, let's look at verses 16 through 22. Yes. Moses' life in Midian. This is Roman numeral 4. Verse 16, I need to pick it up a little bit. Verse 16, it says, now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. So that's what they did routinely, it appears. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. The shepherds bullied them. They had already, it seems like they had already drawn the water and filled the troughs, because the word is in the past tense at the end of verse 16. And the shepherds just bullied them away. And then it says in verse 17, then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up. You remember when he first got there, he sat down. Remember that? And helped them and watered their flock. And so they said, when they came to Reuel, Reuel means friend of God. He was the priest of Midian. Now, it's uncertain whether he was a believer at this point or not, whether he's the priest of the Most High God or the priest of some pagan gods. But it appears to me, even his name, Reuel, means the friend of God, a friend of God. Then they watered, Moses took care of them, and they went back home. When they came home to Reuel, their father, he said, why have you come back so soon today? It seems like what was going on here was routine. And because of Moses being there, taking care of them and driving the shepherds away, allowing them to water their flock as they normally did or would have done, they got it done quicker. And as a result, they went home earlier that day. So Reuel, their father, was a little bit surprised by this. Now notice verse 19. He asked them that question, why are you back so soon today, in verse 18? Now look at 19. So they said, an Egyptian. Now, they didn't, I'm sure after a while they recognized he was not Egyptian, but he may have had on his Egyptian garb or spoke like an Egyptian, I'm not sure. Notice what happened. So they said, an Egyptian delivered us. Who are we talking about? A deliverer, right? He delivered them from the hand of the shepherds. And what is more, this is what they're saying, he drew the water for us. And not only that, he watered the flock. So that's 3 things that's mentioned here. He delivered us from the shepherds, number 1. He drew the water for us, number 2. And then he watered the flock for us. number three. And that's why they got home earlier that day. And Reuel, their father, took note of that. Now, this is really good. This man, Moses, now he's already fled from the palace, and now he's in the desert. He's in the wilderness. He fled from where he was to Midian. That's not a short trip. And that's probably not a lot of water out there. I don't know, there's probably not a lot of food out there. I don't know how he got there, but he got there. Now notice, Reuel was taken back by this. And he seems like he's a little frustrated at their behavior. Look at verse 20. He said to his daughters, that is Reuel, their father, "Where is he then? You have someone this kind, this gentle, behaving this way, doing all of this for you. Where is he? You left him out there?" Reuel may have been thinking, "I have 7 daughters. I need to get married. This may be an opportunity to get at least one of them married now." He said to the daughters, "Where is he? Why is it that you have left him behind?" That's amazing, isn't it? Notice what Reuel said. "Invite him to have something to eat." This man's probably starving. Invite him to have something to eat. By the way, hospitality was a big deal in those days. And so Moses was willing to dwell with him, with the man. And he gave him his daughter, Zipporah. And he gave his daughter, Zipporah, to Moses. So who is Moses' wife? Who is Moses' father-in-law? Reuel or Jethro, right? He's also called Jethro. So we'll see more about that as we go. Then, verse 22, she, Zipporah, gave birth to a son. And he named him Gershom. He said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. In other words, I've been a stranger in a strange land. Now let's go ahead and wrap it up. So he's named Gershom. Does somebody have a son named Gershom? Huh? Gershom, not Gershom. Okay. I'm sorry. Close. Now look at verse 23. The scene is going to shift here. The scene and the people are going to shift. Going to shift from Midian and Moses to Egypt and those who were enslaved there. Now it came about in the course of those many days. This was a long time. This was like 40 years. The king of Egypt died. And the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage. They were still under heavy pressure. And they cried out. And their cry for help because of the bondage rose up to God. Isn't that good? When we cry out to God, our cries rise up to Him. He hears our cries. He hears the cries of His people. And notice verses 24 and 25. So God heard their groanings. When you groan, when you cry to God, He hears you. He may not answer you right away because He has so many other things going on, and this is all in a context. But He hears you. And He knows that you're crying out to Him. And God remembered, not that He forgets, unless He intentionally forgets, He remembered His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is absolutely astounding. You remember back in Genesis chapter 15? What did God tell Abraham? "You won't be around when all this happens, but go in peace. I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to do this. You don't have to be alive, Abraham, when I fulfill this promise I'll make it to you." God will fulfill it. He will remember His covenant that He has made with His people. You could be assured that whatever God has promised you in His word, He will fulfill it in the right time. His time may be different than yours. It normally is. It's different than ours. But He will fulfill it. He goes on. And Jacob, Verse 25, God saw the sons of Israel. He saw them. He's omnipresent. He's everywhere in his full being at the same time. He sees everything. He knows everything. And the latter part of this verse says, and took notice of them. This is an intimate term here. He knew them. He intimately knew them. He knew their situation. He knew their stress. He knew their pressure. He'd already foretold it. What is implied here is that God is now ready to act and to deliver his people from under the huge bondage that they're under. But the point is here, when you need help, cry to God. When God's people cry, he hears. When the righteous cry, God hears. The Lord hears. He hears you. Whatever you're going through now, whatever your challenges are, whatever your difficulties are, cry out to God. He will hear you. I love Philippians 4:6, I believe it is. Do not be anxious about anything, nothing, but in everything, with thanksgiving, with prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, make your requests known to the Lord. He will hear. First Peter talks about casting. That means continuing to cast all of your cares, all of your burdens, all of your stresses, pains, difficulties, challenges, the things that are affecting you that you have no idea how to deal with. Be casting them, continually casting them upon the Lord. Why? For he cares for you. God cares for his people. His son died for his people, and he raised them from the dead. He cares for you too. Let's thank him for it. Father, we thank you so much for this passage. We thank you for the truth that you have revealed to us in your word. We find you to be amazing. You are an amazing God. The more we learn about you, the more awesome and wonderful and amazing we find you to be. Father, may we trust you. You are faithful. Part of your word says you cannot lie. Part of your word says it's impossible for you to lie. You are God of truth. You tell the truth. You are trustworthy. May we trust you. And Father, whatever our circumstances are, may we call upon you. May we look to you for the help that we need. You may not answer the way we want to answer, you to answer at the time, but you will give us what we need to bear up under whatever the pressures are that's causing the difficulty. Father, we love you. We thank you. We praise you. We commit ourselves to you afresh. In Jesus' name, amen.